minute since we've all gathered together on the first tee of another episode of Swing Thoughts. I, of course, am golf spiritual leader. Over there is the man, the author, the raconteur, the storyteller, the sagacious one, author of Getting Unstuck, perfect for the holiday season, is Timberly O'Connor Jr. And it's good to be with you, as always, my friend.
Yeah, good morning. Is sagacious anywhere like loquacious?
If you had to guess the root word of sagacious being sage.
Ooh.
Yeah, means wise one.
Who's the word guy now?
Who's the word guy now? Well, I mean, you could, if you ask in that way, I'd have to guess it was me.
Yeah.
Who's the, I mean, loquacious, I think.
Loquacious.
Again, loquacious.
Loquacious.
Loquacious. Sounds like a Roman senator, but in fact means somebody that is what? Loquacious ability to tell stories.
Prone to talking a lot.
tending to talk a great deal. Talkative.
You know, well, I think that's part of what our the things that we do on this podcast is expand people's horizons, make their, you know, expand their vocabulary.
Oh, absolutely.
Word. What is it? Vocabulary.
Sagacious, having or showing keen mental discernment and good judgment. Whoa. Shrewd.
Mm-hmm.
That is quite the compliment I pay you, and I pay you that compliment unabashedly. I just throw it out there. I'm not holding back any of my feelings for you. This program, baked fresh for you whenever we do it. It's been a few. Wow, this is probably our longest break. Has it been at least 3 weeks, maybe a month?
At least three, perhaps four, yes, as you said.
And are people wondering what's going on? I know I am. Have we broken up?
did Tim and Howard have a tete? No, we just had other things to do.
Yeah.
And have desired a bit of a break. I think that would, that's close to the mark there, I think, that one.
Yeah, we needed a break, and there really hasn't been much golf going on, certainly in my life, and I'll share what I've been doing with you and the listeners in a moment. As far as, there is a break, and we're going to be doing our show, you know, as we do in the off season, every few weeks to every 3 weeks. Tim's busy, I'm trying to get down to a single digit in yoga. It'll come as no, in a minute I'm going to tell you how many classes I did last week. It will come as no surprise to you that I've replaced golf with yoga and Spanish lessons. And you, my friend, you're well. I read in your blog this morning that you have just done some more Mankind stuff that's been keeping you busy.
Yeah. I just came back, from staffing my 28th New Warrior Training Adventure Weekend. And it was really cool. It was different for me because I've been, for most of my time in the Mankind Project, I've been on what they call the leader track, heading towards certification and all that stuff. And I jumped off that about 4 years ago. And so this weekend, I was invited to play the role of an elder, which at 67 years old comes quite naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been
resisting. Especially given how sagacious you are.
Exactly. And how, never mind. So I've actually been resisting this for a long time, thinking, oh, you know, I'm one of those guys out there working and running these processes. So it was quite a different thing. And I really enjoyed it. It was a completely different energy, more sort it's going to sound squishy to some people, sort of blessing energy and seeing people and being of service in a different way. So I really, really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. And I know that we've been talking about it in for most of the 9 years that we've been together doing this show, about how you've been part of that, the Mankind Project. We probably explained it enough by now that regular listeners will know that it's it's not about making men into warriors. It's about remaking men, helping them get to some of the spots, the shadows and the dark areas of our psyches that we don't like to investigate, but once exhumed can lead to some breakthroughs.
Yeah, so bringing those parts of ourselves that are in our blind spots, that are kind of in the dark, and bringing those, you know, into light, into consciousness, and now we can work on them. But it's not about, you know, worshiping wounds and, oh my God, the world's going to hell in a handbasket and all that kind of stuff. It's more about, how can I show up in my world in a more positive way, you know, as a father, as a partner, as a community member, as a world citizen. Basically, the slogan, if you will, and I hate this kind of stuff, but I think it's Mankind Project is dedicated to making the world better, one man at a time. And what I like about it, it's not preachy, it's secular, it's like, however you want to show up, great, everyone's welcome. And it's nonprofit, so there's no selling you stuff. It's, you know, come to a weekend, have the experience, and you know, men generally leave those things really excited at seeing new possibilities for themselves and seeing how capable they are. And about making a positive difference in the world.
Which is never a bad thing. Are you saying that there's no Mankind Project tote bags you can buy? Mankind Project t-shirts and tote bags.
No, yes, you could buy Mankind Project t-shirts and hoodies and this kind of stuff.
Well, okay,
but what I'm saying is that when you do a Mankind weekend, there's no upsell. Oh, you did the bronze package, now we're going to sell you the silver package, and if you're really invested, the platinum. There's none of that stuff. And I don't know. I get really, I don't know, my spidey senses always go up when a lot of organizations bring you in and get you all excited, and then they want to sell you stuff.
Yeah, of course.
That's my own sense of cynicism that I have to work on, because I think that, you know, Mankind Project isn't the only game in town in terms of this kind of stuff. There's lots of great organizations that are doing amazing work. But it's just, I think it's part of my own bullshit that, you know, I get a little bit wondering, what's this about? Is this really about helping out or making some money? Or maybe doing both isn't such a bad thing.
Well, very good. I'm glad you enjoyed the experience. And as I said, a lot of listeners are familiar with the work you do. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, I haven't golfed. This is the longest, not only the break from doing the show with you, but because of the way my schedule has worked out the last 3 years, where, for instance, a year ago, right this moment, I was already in Mexico and had been there for the better part of November of 2023. And I haven't really had a break from golf for quite some time, not just the last year, but the last couple of years. And, you know, it used to be, before the proliferation of indoor golf, which has just gone crazy. I had lunch with our buddy Casey a couple weeks ago, and the kind of plans that they're having there at Burlington Indoor Golf, just amazing. And the fact that Sean stuck with it. Anyway, prior to the how you can go hit balls indoors on every other block now, I remember there was a time, and during the time that we've known each other, there were winters where I would take at least a month or two away from full on making full golf swings, but it's been a few years. And I think that, and I didn't realize the toll it was taking on my body until I stopped doing it. Like, I played golf on the 7th of November. That was the last time I played a full round of golf. And it's now the 27th of November since we've been taking our break, and so on the day we're recording this, it's been fully all those days since
3 weeks. If math serves me correctly,
yeah, it's been 3 weeks since I've hit I made a full golf swing, and just it's been great. And I, you know, I've always done yoga. Usually during the golf season, I do yoga once a week, maybe twice, but. This will come as no surprise to you that last week I did six classes. So I did six classes in 8 days. Six of them.
There's the Howard that I profiled this year, in which pretty well every person I interviewed about you used the word intense.
Oh, yeah. I'm intense about my mindfulness, people. But it's been good. I worked up to it. The first couple of weeks, I did maybe three or four classes. And then last week, just the way it worked out. And I thought, okay, that's that. I found my point where that's too much. It really is. It's a lot of sweat.
Season of balance.
Season of balance. But I will say this, that not making full golf swings for those 3 weeks has been good in that I say I've sort of given my some of the parts of me that have been inflamed. I have like some arthritis in my left thumb that has really been bugging me, and it really bugs me when I swing a golf club. And so it's gotten a little bit better, things like that. And I, you know, again, trying to balance the my love of my intense love of golf with giving it a bit of a break. And I just wonder if maybe some of our listeners, if that's in instructor for them as well, to give it a bit of a rest in the off season.
Oh, I think absolutely. You look at any athlete, and elite athlete, they always build in rest, you know, and then there's action and recovery.
Right.
And it's so, so important. And golfers, in their zeal and their compulsion, say, to get better or to fix the problem that they have that's driving them nuts, will overdo it. I know that a lot of golfers, we're talking like deep golf nerds, you know, people at our obsessive level.
People that listen to this show.
Exactly. So you play a game, and let's say you're just not driving the ball well. You're pushing out in the woods. And so maybe you're going for one little celebratory beverage with your group. But then you go on the range, and you start looking for the cure to what the problem was. And here's the other problem. You've already played 18 holes of golf. You're tired mentally and physically, and there you are in this depleted state trying to find some answer to your golf swing. And not only do you go further down the mental rabbit hole, but because you're not physically adept at that moment, you're not going to play well. So what tends to happen is you don't swing very well, and you leave exhausted and more frustrated than when you got there. Not always, but that's really common.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, if that's not your jam, I mean, I very often, you know, the guys I play with on Saturday make fun of me because if I'm one of the first groups out and we finish and I've got an hour and 20 minutes to wait, while most of those guys go in and they just, you know, sit around drinking beer, which I do not do. So I will go out and hit balls.
No judgment on that.
I'm going out there not so much to find, you know, I'm not going there to find something. I'm going there to work on something that I've already been working on. It's not like, but I'm, again, taking nothing away from your point that that's a frustrating thing to do. But back to the idea of taking a longer break in the winter than I have, I can't imagine it's not going to, like, I'm not, part of me was a little bit worried, like, well, will I lose anything? And I don't think I will. You know,
no,
I don't think
you
that.
Don't.
If I don't, like, I'm not planning now to really go, it's November. I'm not really planning to golf anywhere until February. Now, January, I'll probably start to make some swings so that when I do go golfing, I'll have some, you know, sense of what I'm doing. But I'm definitely taking a couple of months away from it.
Oh, great, great. But your body and brain don't forget how to swing a golf club.
Absolutely.
However many years I've known you now, it's upwards of 12 or so. You've made some changes to your golf swing, but when I play golf with you, it looks like the same golf swing.
Yeah, I know. Crazy, huh?
It's for all of us. You know, one of the greatest stories I heard was, so there's a legendary instructor in Wisconsin named Manuel Delatorre. I just like saying his name.
Yeah, I know.
And he's really highly regarded. And so Mo Norman went and spent some time with Manuel Delatorre. And he came back and he told us, change my swing completely. And everyone looked, and it's the same old Mo swing, you know?
Yeah, I know.
And it's the same for all of us, that you look at your swing and you know, haven't seen, you know, Gern Blanston for 5 years. You look over three fairways and you go, I think that's Gern Blanston.
That is Gern. And if anybody knows somebody named Gern, please write us.
That's a very good point. That's a Steve Martin ripoff.
No, I know, I know, I know that name. It's a very good point that I've, you know, I'm always working on something, and then I'll film it, and it's like, oh yeah, looks pretty much. I mean, where I think you can have an effect in the off season is things that are like not so hard in your body. Like you can work on your setup. You can work on your, you can work on the ball position. You can work on, I mean, I just don't want to go through the another entire winter where I'm making nothing but, you know, golf swing after golf swing, because I don't think it's helping me. And I think mentally I need a break. But that's, so that's one thing. We were talking just before we hit record about some podcasts, and I couldn't remember if we had recorded since you were on Carl, the Carl Morris. But if anyone, again, if sorry for our lack of memory, but if you haven't heard Tim on with Carl Morris, go check out the Mind Factor podcast. Is that what he's calling it? It's
no, it's Mind Caddy. Now.
Mind Caddy.
Yeah.
So the Mind Caddy podcast with Carl, I'm on it as well. If you haven't heard that episode, and because of my appearance on that podcast, I recently recorded with a guy from Northern California named Kelvin Kelly. Kelvin Kelly has a podcast. I would be really good if I knew the name of it, but go check him out. He's on Spotify. And it was a very interesting conversation. He heard me talking about sobriety, and so that's kind of what we talked about. It's called the Kelvin Kelly Golf Podcast is what it is.
That's really interesting. I'm really curious, what was the core thing that you guys discussed as perhaps relates to golf?
Well, we talked about how drinking had a physiological impact on me, but mentally that physical, like, just my whole point to Kelvin, and I mentioned it on the show before too, that when I stopped, there was a change in me physiologically that affected me psychologically. That's kind of what we talked about. You know, better able to handle the vagaries of the game sober. At least for me, it was a big difference. So that's kind of what we talked about.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I've recently had some discussions with clients and some friends about alcohol. And one of the things that has come up from a couple of friends is they say that alcohol is a way, in essence, of avoiding yourself, of the real things that are going on. And so, you know, a couple glasses of wine, a beer or two or whatever, and it maybe just kind of numbs out the stuff that's been bugging you, or the things that you think, you know, I got to get around to that. And what I mean to that, it could be having an awkward conversation, dealing with a behavior that you don't like, that you want to change, but the alcohol is a way to kind of numb it, make it temporarily go away. Is that anywhere close to your experience?
Or? Yeah, I would say that, you know, I drank to excess, obviously, to get away from yourself, you know, get away from myself. But what is that old thing? You know, wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah.
But as far as how alcohol affects golfers, I mean, I think there's, I play with a few guys that drink a lot on the golf course. I never did. You know, part of my competitive obsessiveness, I just didn't want to be drunk while I was playing, and didn't even drink that much, you know, with the boys after a round. I drank a couple of beers. But that wasn't, you know, for me, the serious drinking began when I got, you know, when I got home. But for a lot of golfers, I think that, you know, especially the ones that drink during a round of golf, like Saturday morning, I play with some guys that are drinking beer pretty early in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Like, weirdly so. And that's the thing about golf, is it kind of allows you to say, well, I'm just playing golf. I can have a few beers. It's 9:30, you know, totally, it's 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, no, it's the same at I coach at the golf house in Guelph, and so a lot of the you go in there on a Tuesday at 9 a.m., and some of the guys got like the birdie juice going.
Seriously?
Yeah, exactly. I know, it's kind of surprising. And it's kind of like those guys, I don't know.
Birdie juice makes me laugh.
I know.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, that is actually a brand name, to be honest.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
that's funny.
Lubricating fluid, whatever you want to call it. But it often makes me think. I mean, so you have 2, 3, 4 drinks. You drive home, not so good. And then how do you show up with your partner? Just like, you know, what do you do? Collapse on the couch, wake up and say, what's for dinner? That wouldn't get it in my house, I'll tell you that.
No, I know. But I've met your boss. She's not going to stand for that shit.
Yeah, but it also makes me wonder about those guys, married, most of them, who like every men's night they're there, every Saturday, every Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Every holiday they're there. Friday nights they're there. I don't know how that union stays together. Is it duct tape or I don't know.
Well, that's a whole other conversation that
I know we're all over the place. Say, sorry.
No, that's fine. I'll just tell you back to Kelvin Kelly's golf podcast. You can go hear me on it, as well as guests included Michael Hebron, Carl Morris. Cool. He's had some good names on there. Brad Lamb, not the one from the condo association. Jim Waldron. Who else has he had on? Anyway, go check it out. Oh, look at here. Episode 22, Nick Price. How does he get Nick Price? He's got Ledbetter on. I gotta call the guy and say, hey, can you give us your contact for Nick Price?
I might have a number for.
Let's get Nick on the show. He's had Raymond Pryor on, Foley. Who does he think he is? Rubenstein? These are all our people. Oh, Bradley Hughes, too. Anyway.
We had them first, though. We had them first.
Somebody we had on our show. Here's, I'm going to segue now. Somebody we had on our show, somebody that I sort of stumbled upon, and a couple people used to refer to her as my girlfriend, but Kathy Hart Wood.
Oh, yes.
You know, she was great. She has her own podcast called Under Par. What is her podcast called? Over Par or something. I don't know.
Well, you're looking for that. Her
Think Above brother, Par is what it's called.
Her brother played on the tour.
That's right. Dudley Hart was her brother.
Dudley Hart, yeah.
And so I picked this out because you and I and Kent, Kent and I, you and Kent, all variations of those three human beings.
Of the triumvirate.
Have talked about this on our show, away from our show, with one another, in group discussions and individually. See, that's loquacious. That, my friends, is loquacious manifest. No,
that borders on verbose.
Exactly. Oh yeah, I could keep going. Anyway, Kathy Hart Wood. I get her newsletter or whatever, and it came in this morning. I thought, oh, that's something that Tim and I could talk about, and that is gratitude. You and I, and Kent, we've all been talking about gratitude as an integral component in the enjoyment of this game. Not getting better, but enjoying it. So Kathy's latest podcast, because it's American Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Is her whole thing is about gratitude. And I like what she says here. It's not going to be new to our listeners, but it is an interesting perspective, talking about things you're grateful for around Thanksgiving. She said, but what if this Thanksgiving you started a new habit, one that not only improves your game, but also transforms how you handle challenges both on and off the course, and that is via gratitude. She says it's not just for Thanksgiving. It's a powerful tool that, when practiced daily, rewires your brain for resilience, calm, and focus. One last sentence from her, and then we can talk about how this relates to what we do. Science shows it can improve, gratitude can improve your mood, reduce anxiety, and as a result, boost your performance on the course. So if you're a fan of hers, as I am, it's her latest podcast, Think Above Par. She talks a lot about this. And I was just thought I'd throw it back on you, because I know that gratitude is an integral part of getting unstuck.
Yeah, there it is. The sixth practice among the seven transformational practices for golf nerds. Gratitude is a big piece, and I think where golfers can make a direct connection to their game is that I look at gratitude as this way. everything is just as it should be right now. I feel thankful for this moment. I feel thankful for my ability to play golf. I have the means to play golf. I have a healthy body. And when we're in that place, to me, the bonus of that is that we're in the present moment. There's no wanting, craving, ruminating, regretting. We're just in a really good place. And I think to play good golf, to enjoy the game, to experience, you know, the sun on your back, joking with your pals, your friends, family, that gratitude piece, just, it's like an anchor to being in a really good place, which is, to me, always generally in the present moment.
Yeah, you know, I'm not saying that we started it or Kenton, you and I, whatever, but we've been talking about that for some time, about being in the present moment. What are the pathways, neural and otherwise, to get you into that spot, whether it's the zone or whether it's a feeling of equanimity? But it's sort of interesting to me that she's been doing her podcast for some time, but and this for my... It seems to me the first time I've seen her mention this, but isn't it interesting that it's going to become adopted by so many people that teach what we talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things is that I think people are coming to realize is that when we talk about, say, you know, a practice, it's not yet another thing to do that takes time and effort. It's more of just a slight mind shift of aware and being aware. So when I'm in a place of, say, gratitude, it's an experience of more than anything else. It's not a trying to be, it's not a reframing. It's like, oh, I should be grateful right now because, oh my gosh, things could be so much worse.
That's right.
You know, it's nothing like that. It's just like, okay, right now this is good. And gratitude often comes to us in like little moments. You know, where it's like, you know, walking down a fairway and the clouds part and the sun goes on your back, like, oh man, that feels good.
Yeah.
That's a moment of gratitude, I think.
I agree.
It brings us into our body and tends to press pause on, you know, the goofy thoughts we have about, oh, how come I'm pushing my driver out to the right all the time?
I was reading some Kent Osborne stuff. And by the way, speaking of Kent, there's a special announcement at the end of this podcast. Ooh. Do you remember we talked about this? I'm going to tack that thing on.
Okay.
Do you remember or don't remember?
No, I don't remember. I'm an old person.
Okay. Well, I'll remind you. You know what? It'll be a surprise for everybody in a few minutes. You know, one of the things not that I disagree with him, but to Kent, there is the physical game, the mental game, meaning in his mind, he separates the mental part of the game with, you know, the techniques of breathing and, you know, anything that's a technique, like a pre-shot routine or strategy or having your eyes up and your body physically in a positive manner. He thinks that's a separate category. And he puts gratitude and the idea of golf should be fun as a separate entity. And I see it and I don't see it. Like, I think your whole mental strategy includes gratitude. And what do you think of that? Because there are mental techniques that you don't have to be grateful to have a good pre-shot routine. You don't have to be grateful to take your turn when it's your turn, etc. What do you think?
Well, I think that any time that we're, in essence, trying to do something, we're using our intellect. We're thinking. It's like I'm walking down a fairway and I'm thinking about, oh, if I par in, I'm going to shoot my best score this year. What could I do to stop thinking about that? Oh, I know. I'll do the eyes up, tits up thing from Paul, and I'll do that. And so I'm thinking about that. And or any other technique, I'm going to feel my body and that kind of thing, or whatever. There's so many of these mental techniques. To me, gratitude is more sort of a mindset that I'm just going to be in this experience. Whatever happens, Man, they're certainly interconnected, and I don't think that there is a dividing line between them. But when I think it's the difference between trying and accepting, allowing, yeah. And I think that that's the latter, accepting, allowing, are more in the gratitude space of just I'm allowing this moment to happen. It's almost like when you see a gorgeous sunset. Let's say you're, you know, down in Mexico or someplace, and there's people on the beach, and all have their phones out.
Yeah,
they're trying to capture the moment so they can relish it later. To me, more in the gratitude space is, I'm just going to allow myself to be witness and observe and experience this amazing thing, and I'm not even really thinking at all. It's just I just watching the sun go down and everything. It's just amazing. So I think that's partly gratitude as well. I don't know.
I would agree with that.
Is that clear as mud?
No, I get it. I get the all the things that we've talked about over the years here about the techniques around the mental game, whether it's Fawcett's strategy or, you know, Ed Collins, spelt Coughlin. Yeah.
Pronounced Collins.
It's only been 8 years I've been saying. It's Ed Collins. You know, putting yourself in, you know, in game situations. But gratitude, as a, I think it's more of a philosophical construct, an idea where, you know, bringing something different to your golf game. And, you know, I think I have a fairly good amount of it. I think I have, I'm constantly struck by those moments of, you know, you close your eyes and the breeze hits you in a certain way that has nothing to do with whether you've got a 7-iron into the green or not. And I think sometimes, because of the type of golf I play, and the type of golf a lot of people play, it gets pretty intense, where you don't always take a moment or two and savor those, you know, those rounds where, you know, it doesn't really matter what you're shooting if the fact is you're just playing and having fun. And I think for me, I'd like to have more of those rounds, more of those moments.
Yep.
I can tell you my last round of the year on the 7th of November was played at the National, and I was there as part of we have a Champions Day there. And I can't remember if we did a podcast after that. I don't know if we did. Did we? You can't remember.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did.
Yeah, but I had a lot of gratitude that day.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of, it was the last day, and it was a beautiful, perfect fall day, no wind, 14 degrees. Yep. And so that day was less about, what am I going to shoot here at this ridiculous golf course? And more about, like, I just soak it all in. And many, many times that day, I just stood and looked back at where we had been or where we were going. And
fantastic.
And it does do what it does do what Kathy Hart says. It does keep you calm, centered. You know, you go from a mindset of mild frustration, which is golf. You know, it's kind of mildly, even if you're evolved, you're always a little mildly. It's there, you know. But
You hit one sideways, you're not going to be happy about it.
Well, yeah, but golf, it gives us that. But it also gives us the opportunity to find a way to work through that. I was going to say work around it, but to work through it.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Speaking of things that we've said on this show before.
Things that we've said on this program.
So, way back when I first met you and you asked me to coach you, and you were really struggling with your game. I don't think you'd broken, you know, for someone who's about a 2 or 3 handicap, you hadn't broken 80 in a couple of weeks, and you came this close to banging your driver on one of those stone tee markers at Glencairn.
Yeah.
Hey, every golf nerd knows we're on that knife edge of violence. Anyways, and I remember saying to you, you know, why don't you have an intention? It could be you'll be the best partner you've ever been, or gratitude. And you picked being the best partner. And so, and remember you phoned me back a couple of days. I said, how'd it go? I said, great. I met these new guys. They're new pals. They had such a good time. Oh, and by the way, I shot 74.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It sets us up.
Yeah.
It sets us up in a way in which we're sort of more, to use a Judson Brewer word, we're more expansive. We're outside of ourselves. It's less of shining a very tight spotlight on myself, like, how am I doing today? And that, to me, is in that place where – And also another thing, I'll just prattle on a little bit more. I remember doing a workshop at Mississauga, and a guy who, deep golf nerd, always wanted to break 80, he takes his dad out to play Mississauga. He's so proud to show his dad this amazing golf course. So it's all about his dad, looking for his golf ball, making sure his dad, you know, his dad's an older guy, having a good time, all this. And when the guy added up his scorecard, he realized he had shot 76. His best score by about 6 or 7 stroke [S2] Wow. [S1] In a couple of years, because he was in that more expansive state.
Yeah, and it's no surprise, you know, as in a game where we're so inwardly focused, even without even knowing how internal, there's this internal dialogue that we all have in our lives, but it's exacerbated in the game of golf, that just that little switch of other focused, whether it's somebody else or the environment, it strangely enough does lead to better outcomes.
Yeah, and I think that's where we feel gratitude too. I mean, yes. I don't know how many times I've been on the golf course and went, man, this is amazing. I have such a great time with my buddies, or even with Howard.
What do you mean, my buddies, or even with Howard? What does that mean?
I just wanted to sneak that in just if you're listening. That's
I'm
all.
Listening.
You're supposed to yes and that.
Yes, now I did. I was like, what the fuck is that all about? That was yes anding. Listen, fella, we got to be completely transparent with our audience, I believe. And also from the Swing Thoughts sales department.
There you go.
Just to throw it out there, we've been very lucky for a long time. TaylorMade was our title sponsor. Over the years, we've had Oscar Bravo. And at one point, we had TaylorMade Adidas.
That's
and
right.
At another point, we had clothing supplied by... Can't remember his name either.
Fairway Green. Jonathan Wong.
Yeah, great, great.
Fairway Green. Neuro Peak Pro.
Right. And so here we find ourselves in the fall of 2024. And we've got some feelers out. But I would just say, if there's anyone in the golf business or golf adjacent business, or anyone with any kind of business that would like to be part of this program going into 2025, that you can get a hold of us. I'm easy to get a hold of, humblehoward@gmail.com. And Mr. O'Connor, what email would you be okay giving out on this program?
Tim@oconnorgolf.ca. No apostrophe, and it's O'Connor, O-R.
Yeah, so, we're just looking to make some new partnerships. We've been very, very lucky with TaylorMade for a long time, and they're a good bunch of guys there, and they've been very supportive of us, and they've just decided to, go in a different direction, as they say, and that's fine. I mean, I've been in this radio business a long time, and sponsorship comes and goes.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I just thought I'd throw it out there to anyone that's interested in, into maybe being part of this show.
Yeah, so speaking of gratitude, we're both really grateful to being affiliated with Nick and Jamie and the guys at TaylorMade. I mean, a wonderful group, but everything evolves. You know, nothing, as the Buddhists say, everything's impermanent. So things move along, and one thing I know that's really... what I really enjoy about doing this podcast is interacting with our sponsors and having fun with them and talking about their gear or their clothing. It really is fun. So there's a bit of a sales pitch, folks, for getting involved with our podcast. It's a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun.
And we reach deep golf nerds.
Yeah. If you're looking for, there's a certain kind of audience that we have that we think we can deliver. And if you're looking for it, we'd be happy to chat with you. I don't have a whole lot more, but I do have to. I do want to remind you that, and we don't have to stop now. But I'm just going to let you know that. Speaking of Kent Osborne, a few weeks ago, Kent was over here in the studio, and just like you and him, you and I, when we aren't recording, we have all kinds of conversations. Now you remember?
Now I remember.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, now I remember. Yeah.
So. Basically, when you and I record an episode, it's kind of like what you and I would talk about, even if we weren't recording it. And that's very much like, Kent and I went on a road trip with a guy. We were in the car on the way there. We spent 14 hours driving over 2 days and almost never listened to a podcast, the radio, or the news. We just found ourselves babbling for 14 totally. Hours about golf, about yeah. life, about religion. So when Ken was over hanging out here, I said, you know, why don't you sit down? Why don't we record one of these conversations? And I'll throw it on to the next episode of A Swing Thoughts. So when we say goodbye in a couple minutes here, Tim and I, you're going to hear the Sultans of Swing, and that will fade out. And then I'll just bring up a conversation with Kent Osborne and myself about the world of golf and other stuff. And you may or may not like it, but you know, you can always fast forward through it.
No, I think people will love it. Ken is such a cool guy. I'm so, speaking of gratitude again, gratitude part nine here, so grateful that I got to meet Kent through you, and as with a lot of other people, just a really interesting guy, amazing background. He coached Fortune 500 executives, did that kind of work, and also for a number of years, he was, in essence, the performance coach for the Detroit Red Wings. So the guy's got a real good grounding in the whole area of sports psychology and that kind of thing. Fascinating guy and very funny, too.
So I hope you enjoy that. That'll be coming up here in a couple moments when we say goodbye. Anything else that you'd like to air out here before we shut it down?
Yeah, take a look, folks, at my blog, the recent one. It's an excerpt from my new book, Getting Unstuck. It's a story about one of my my meltdowns that we've recounted on this show before. I think Deep Golf Nerds will resonate with, again, as I mentioned earlier, that knife edge we are perched upon when we play golf between bliss and abject violence.
It's a great story.
And what we can learn from those things.
You know, I reread it today, and I was like, man, I can relate. You know, I played a lot of golf with my father. And as I got older, you know, you talk about, you know, wanting to show your dad a good time. You know, I remember he would come to Toronto and play golf with me. And, you know, growing up on the golf course we did at Moose Jaw, where, you know, it wasn't the most fancy. It was the Moose Jaw Golf and Curling Club, so it wasn't super fancy. And then sort of the dichotomy, or is that the word, like the contrast yep. of, you know, bringing my dad to the National. You know, I've got some great pictures of him and I on some holes, and it's pretty, you know, it was pretty cool for me to bring him out there. But, and I can tell you, I had my lowest round ever at that golf course with my father. And nice. You want to talk about grateful, you know, I did it a couple times. But the first time I shot in the 60s at the National, one of three times I did it. But the first time I did it, it was so unusual. And it was my father and two members, and I shot 68.
Wow. And at the Nash.
At the pro at the time, you want to talk about screwing up your handicap, because 68 was like, the course rating was 75 point something.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, it definitely dropped me down a bit. But my father was there, and they took my scorecard and bronzed it like a baby shoes. Like, I have a bronze scorecard with my father's signature on it. And the day we shot that, you know, like, it was pretty cool for me to do that, especially again, to bring him there and also to have that round of golf. And I've told a story where he and the other two guys in my group didn't talk to me from the 15th hole until the totally. Fairway at 18. No one spoke a word. And I was like, and it wasn't until I got the ball in play on 18 that they were kind of like, oh, okay, everything's all right. And I'm like, where the fuck have you guys been? They were like, we didn't want to say anything. And I get
That's
it.
Right.
You don't want to, yeah, it's like it's watching like a no hitter.
Or, yeah, your goalie's got a shutout going.
Right.
But, you know, isn't that, I mean, that's this amazing game. I mean, we talked earlier about, you know, I love the phrase that you use from time to time about the vagaries of the game. Love that. You know, it one part of it, we're playing the game and we're done, and we punch the inside of our car and break our windshield.
I love, you know, and the other one is you say our. I love what you say. We do. Only one of us has punched the inside of the windshield. But,
Yeah, but my blog today is about me decapitating my driver, my $600 driver, you know, by whacking my wedge against my stand bag. What an idiot. But there, and then in between, and we have this lovely moment with our parents. Yes. I mean, just I was talking to a client yesterday, working with this guy, and so he's been playing really well, but the last four games, not so great. He talked to me about driving home from the golf course after yet another round. He's screaming at himself. He's screaming. He said, if anyone saw me in my car, they would have thought I was just having an episode, a psychotic, absolute fucking meltdown. And it's just, oh my goodness, what a game. And what we do to ourselves when we play it.
Yeah, I know. It's it really is something. And I, again, reading your blog about you smashing your driver, at least it was within the confines of the game. I got into my car and punched my windshield. Like, one of us needs help. Anyway, so once again, to reiterate Tim's blog, his Substack is available at O'ConnorGolf.ca. And the book, Getting Unstuck, perfect for in time for the holidays. I'm imagining we'll do another show before Christmas, which is now less than a month away. So, I won't wish you well now, although I do wish you well anyway, just blanketly, you know.
Yeah, just, you know, it's just a common courtesy because it's nice to say.
That's right. Just common courtesy.
It's not like, okay, I hope between now and the next time we have a podcast, you fall and break your leg.
Yeah, or say like, I wish everyone well, even Tim. Okay.
Touché. Yes, right. And
so here's the deal. We're not we'll thank TaylorMade for all the years of support. We certainly appreciate it.
Yeah.
And Oscar Bravo, amazing. Thanks to them. And hopefully in 2025 we'll have some new people to thank. In the meantime, I thank you, Mr. So and So, Mr. O'Connor.
Right back at you.
This program is produced by the Humble and Fred Show. All rights and whatever are reserved. And
so
as I
like,
what's that?
So businesslike.
Oh yeah, and you can find out more at humbleandfredradio.com. And as I said, you're going to hear the music fade out in a second, and then a conversation with Scratch Attitude Kent Osborne. Until next time.
Step inside, but you don't see too many faces.
All right, a rare opportunity to have the Kent man in studio. Kent Osborne, Scratch Attitude. How long have we known each other now?
Has it been 5 years?
Something like that. 3 or 4 or 5 years, something, you know. Doesn't matter, we're old. Could have been last week. I've no
it could have been 1963.
I have no idea. I've mentioned on the show many times that we became friends, but it started off as I reached out to you when I found you on Twitter. And what got you started on, what brought you to Twitter as a way to spread the message and gospel of KO?
Well, it was actually my my buddy John Alpa. I would share with him my perspective on golf. He's a guy who's been into golf all his life. He's a Golf Digest course rater. He's been involved in building and managing courses. Works in the golf industry. Knows a lot about it.
Yeah,
great guy, great player. And I would talk to him about my perspective on the game because I started late. I started when I was 50 and came to the game basically with a beer league softball mentality, in the sense that I'm here for recreation, period, end of story. And one of the first things I noticed when I get into golf as a quote-unquote serious hobby was that the better you were, the less likely you were to have fun actually playing the game.
So you observed that pretty quickly as you got into pretty golf. Quick. Now you say, like, I don't want to question the origin story, but when you say you got into golf at 50,
uh-huh.
And you were a pretty good athlete as a kid. You played hockey, baseball.
Yeah.
But did you ever play any golf as a kid?
I would say I probably played, I think I played a round of golf for the first time ever when I was maybe 23 or something like that.
So you weren't like a lot of people that had sort of done it in their teens. Like I played a lot as a kid from like age 11 till 17 or 18. Then I stopped for about 15 years or 12 years because I, you know, I was in my 20s. I was traveling around. And my point is, when you came back at 50, you really hadn't played a lot of golf as a kid.
I drove into the, I can remember, I didn't, you know, I'd read the sign bag drop, like, what's that? Like, or yeah. Ball washer.
Of course.
Yeah, ball washer. And I'd be like, what the hell is that?
At our age now, bag drop means a completely different thing.
Yeah, that's true.
So
but anyway, John, I'd be talking to John about my perspective.
Right.
And he would say, shit, man, you know, you should get on Twitter. You should share these ideas with people. You know, there's probably some value in them. And so I just went on Twitter and kind of started tweeting stuff.
Which is where I found you. And that was prior. I don't think you'd written your first book, which is, it's changed names. What was it originally called?
I think I originally called it Play Like Ray.
Play Like Ray, that's right. I read
now
that.
Now I call it Scratch Attitude. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah.
So you came to golf in your 50s.
Yep.
By the time I met you, you were mid-60s. You'd won club championship. You were a high-level player. You turned yourself into a, you know, scratch or scratch-adjacent golfer. Very low handicap.
Mostly adjacent.
That's right. I like to use that term because people say to me,
like,
are you scratch? I go, well, depends on the month, but I'm scratch adjacent. So what was it about golfers that you noticed right away that we were maybe not as filled with joy as we might be? That must have been a surprise that we spent all this time doing this stuff and we're not having very much fun.
I get into it just serendipitously because I'm playing recreational softball on a team that arguably would be one of the worst in North America. We were horrible, but we had fun. And you know, well, after every game we'd get together, we'd have a beer around this guy's truck, and we'd hand out a trophy for the worst play of the night, and the trophy was an artificial leg with a baseball cleat in the bottom of it. And trust me, there was no problem with deciding who was going to get it. The issue was which of the five bumbles would you give it to. But anyway, I started playing golf with some of the same guys on that team, and there was a stark contrast between how they would be on the playing ball. And, you know, they wanted to win, and they wanted to make, you know, hit the ball and catch the ball and all that kind of stuff. But the stress and the
right.
and the negative reaction just didn't seem to be there.
So
as I said earlier, it seemed to me like if you had four guys in a foursome and one of them was scratch, one of them was five, one of them was 10, and one of them was 20. And if you said, okay, one of these guys is going to be pissed off with how he plays today, chances are it would be
the lower handicap
guy. Lower guys.
But back to the idea that you were playing baseball or softball with guys that had no trouble being horrible at it and having fun, in stark contrast to people that supposedly, like the lower handicap people, that were actually pretty good at the sport, but it was almost inverse. They weren't having the same amount of fun.
Yeah, well, like if I had been sitting around with the boys after a game and I had said, you know what, guys, I don't know, but I think my hands are moving a little too far inside to out, and my batting average has gone down, you know, I think 20 points in the last three weeks, and I found a guy used to be a hitting coach for the Blue Jays, and I'm going to go spend an hour with him, and you know, for $150 he's going to
hit balls indoors.
They look at me like have you lost your mind?
Yeah.
So whatever it is about golf, it's a very, very different animal.
So you notice that right away.
Yeah.
Again, coming from this idea of beer league softball, having fun, giving out a funny little thing at the end of the game. No one feels shame and embarrassed. And as you just said, nobody's signing up for batting lessons with an ex-Blue Jay hitting coach. How soon, should I say, when you got into golf, did you start to realize, well, maybe there's a better way or a different way, or maybe there's another avenue that I could take?
Well, it was probably, I think it was, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years in, and I started to get to the point where I could shoot in the 80s on a regular basis, and I was as crazy as anybody else. You know, I would get pissed off if I didn't, you know, shoot my 84 instead of, you know, if I went out and shot 92 that day.
Right.
And I just thought, man, I'm falling into the same traps that I saw these other guys fall into, and I don't want to do that. So thankfully, I have a background as a mental health counselor and executive coach, and I was able to look at some of the things I've learned along the way there, specifically this whole field of emotional intelligence. And I was able to go, okay, how do I want to approach this thing? And that's where the whole scratch attitude, that's the genesis of the whole scratch attitude idea.
You know, it's interesting that a lot of golf, I mean, it's been, you know, obviously the basis of my little swing thoughts, you know, not, I don't know why I said my little, the show Swing Thoughts, we've talked about the mental side of the game. But you and I have talked about this, you and O'Connor and I have talked about that I don't know that the mental side of golf really sums up what you're talking about, because most people think about, you know, mental strategy, as a way of being so that you can, you know, push away those demons that we all have. But I think you think of it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I look at, to me, I look at it, there's four quadrants that go into this, you know, the alchemy of your golf. One of them is physical fitness or golf fitness. One of them is your golf technique or your ability with the 14 clubs. Another one is your mental game. And the fourth one is your emotional skill.
Right.
I would draw a distinction between your mental game and your emotional skill.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. I think you think about emotional intelligence as it relates to golf differently than a lot of the gurus of the mental side.
Yeah, it's not, for me, it's not a subset of the mental game. It's its own thing. And in the same way that, if you were to, if we were to go play golf, say in the spring, and, you know, I normally hit it X amount off the tee, and we play around in the spring, and I go, holy shit, like I'm 20-30 yards shorter than where I was last year. Well, there's nothing I can do about my golf fitness during that round.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to do something about it, I'm going to need to go to the gym or start yoga or whatever the heck. And hopefully a month or 2 months or 3 months down the road, I'll have that swing speed back. On the emotional side of the game is the same. If you're on the golf course and you're finding yourself habitually stressed, habitually anxious, or habitually frustrated and angry, from my perspective, there's no Jedi mind trick
mm-hmm.
that's going to get you out of that state. Yes, you can do some breathing, or you can, you know, say something positive to yourself, and you might drop yourself down from a 9-level anxiety to a 7 or 6, or you might drop yourself from a 9 frustration to a 7 or 6, but you're not going to fundamentally alter that state. So my perspective is you need to cultivate positive emotions off the golf course in the same way that you cultivate your fitness off the golf
course. It's a practice like any other aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah, and as a recreational player, as a beer league golfer, that doesn't mean that I'm going to approach it in the same way that a pro might. But it does mean that I'm going to take a few minutes on a regular basis just to do some things that'll help me be on the golf course with more of a sense of gratitude and acceptance and joy, and less of a sense of, you know, expectation and frustration.
And I, like, we don't differ on this. I think we've discussed this before, that either or, whether you're working on your breathing or you're trying to be more present during a round of golf or you're trying not to be as frustrated, it's as much a practice as, you know, journaling off the course and looking back at your rounds with gratitude. Yeah. And all of those things, like, they're either, I think, yeah, they're either or, but they're both a technique and a practice. You know, like you can say if a golfer's frustrated on day one, you can practice, you know, breathing, whatever it is, being more present. And 90 days later, hopefully you've made some changes. And as far as your emotional, you know, equanimity, it's again, it's not something you can do on only one day. It's something you want to sort of adopt on many days.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I like to do something. The journaling is a big thing for me, but I like to do things off the golf course.
Right.
Spend 5 or 10 minutes after a round, and focus on. To me, your emotions are like a muscle, and the more you use it, the more you're inclined that way. So, the more I consciously connect with something, with things that I'm grateful for, the more I'm going to be inclined to be grateful down the road.
Right.
And to me, gratitude is the key emotion. I mean, yeah, confidence is nice and et cetera. But if I've got gratitude, I'm going to be able to, my goal, if I'm playing in a golf tournament, is I want to be able to let golf be golf.
Mm-hmm.
And which means that if I'm letting golf be golf, which I'm going to play, I'm going to have some great rounds. I'm going to have some okay, some good rounds, some okay rounds.
Some Oshawa.
I think is all your fault, yeah. But that's another fault.
We were going to get to Oshawa at some point in that list.
But if I'm not able to let golf be golf,
right?
If my emotions are sabotaging me, I can't access those great rounds. That'll never happen.
What do you think of this? I think gratitude is like the icebreaker ship.
Yeah.
You know, if you have gratitude, it really can take care of all the other emotions behind it.
Yeah.
Because it's breaking the ice of perspective. That's what I wanted to say. Do you think that gratitude,
yes,
gives you perspective?
Yes. It's the key that unlocks it. It's the icebreaker, whatever you want to call it. It's the one thing, if someone was to say to me, hey, you know what, my emotions are, you know, sabotaging my efforts on the golf course, what can I do? I would say get into a habit of gratitude. And down the road, it will change things for you.
I would agree. In almost every round of golf, including playing yesterday, which might be my last round of the year, I took many breaks during that round to look around, to do a 360 of where I was and trying to mentally soak it in, to have that as a real anchored sense, which is why I throw it back to you. Like, cultivating an attitude of gratitude really does buffer all the other vagaries of the game.
Yeah, fair enough. Because, I mean, I'm going to, perhaps the pros are in the same boat. I don't know. I've never been close to that level of golf. But there's no doubt that I'm going to go out and screw up. I'm going to hit bad shots. I'm going to make bad decisions. I'm going to miss putts. Even in my best round.
Yeah, I was there at Oshawa. I saw it.
You saw it. So, gratitude is the thing that allows you to just, you know, take a breath and move through this.
Yeah.
Now, there's no doubt about it. I have more fun when I'm playing my best than I do when I'm playing my worst. This is not about, you know, singing, you know, be happy kind of thing when you're on the bogey train. But gratitude's key, man.
Yeah.
Were you or I actually grateful for anything after Oshawa?
Yeah, for people who don't. Yeah, we, Kent and I were partners in a Ontario Senior Am qualifier where neither of our games showed up at the same time, and you know, it was pretty grim. it was pretty grim while it was going on, but we went to Five Guys Burgers after, and we drowned our sorrows in burgers and gravy and fries and
milkshakes too.
Milkshakes, that's right. Being competitive, which I know you are,
mm-hmm,
how do you align your natural, and this might be for somebody listening, like, we all want to do better. As you say, it's more fun when you're playing well. So how does being competitive align with your tenet or of your anchoring gratitude in what you do?
Well, to me, there's kind of two. The way I think of it is like, I think it was Bobby Jones who said, there's golf and then there's tournament golf.
Mm-hmm.
So what I like to do is I think about yin and yang. You never hear it said yang yin. It's always said yin yang, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's put first things first. So the first thing for me is you get your heart in the right place. You understand, I know why I'm there. I'm a paid, every tournament I go in, I'm paying to be there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm there for recreational enjoyment. I get anchored into a positive state that hopefully allows me to let golf be golf. And then on the yang side, to be honest, I do some things around the self-belief as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because my perspective is that you cannot do anything that's outside of your belief system. So if you, and beliefs, one way to think of it is that you've got this little 5-6-year-old somewhere in your subconscious. The beliefs operate fairly, they're simple, but they're very powerful. So if you believe that you're worthy enough to achieve something, then chances are you'll perform in a way that, you know, all things considered, that will enable you to do that. But if at a deep level, let's say if my game is not at this level, as you know, but let's say that I was, attempting to qualify for the PGA Tour. And if I don't believe that I'm worthy to be there, it doesn't matter how well I can strike it. It doesn't matter how well I can course management. It doesn't matter who my caddy is. It doesn't matter. You will not exceed your core beliefs. At least that's my perspective.
Do you think that most people are held back by that in their games? That somewhere that they...
I can say that I was. I can say that. I can't say
because that's not something most people would ever think to address. Or if they did think to address it, wouldn't be... They'd be reticent to address that because, as you say, you can have all the good conditioning and clubs and you've got a good swing and you're a pretty good player. But if somewhere down deep you don't believe that you belong in that group, you think that holds you back?
Yes. I'm convinced that that's true in every aspect of our lives.
It's pretty hard to overcome that.
Yes. And it can be overcome. It can be... I mean, this last season was arguably despite Oshawa, was the best competitive season that I've had. And, you know, I started the season by consciously deciding to do some work on me. I mean, it's easy as a coach to help everybody else on the planet do work on themselves. But sometimes you need to look in the mirror. And so I felt that I needed some work on my belief.
So what did you change?
Well, I would, I would on a daily basis, every morning, I would sit down and write down I am statements, and I would write down what I felt was the golf of my dreams, and I would then write down what I call convincers that would align with that, because the way your belief system works is that I could say to myself, okay, I was a pretty good goalie when I was a kid. I want to be the starting goalie for the Leafs next year. And I could create a mental image of that and I could do all that kind of stuff. But at some level, my subconscious would go, wait a minute, pal, you weren't that good to start with, even when you were back when you were 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You're certainly not that good at 69. So let's just, you know, it ain't going to happen. So what I wanted to do was basically convince myself that...
Almost reconfigure your belief hard drive a little
bit. Yeah, like I would start... I'll tell you what I started with. I would start with an I am statement, and my I am statement was, I'm born to be an athlete. I easily and naturally enter flow state every time I have an opportunity to hit a golf ball. And that to me was, that to me was convincing me that on a couple levels. One, that I don't need to do anything. I don't need to learn anything. I don't need to get better. I don't need to do anything whatsoever than connect with the truth that I'm born to be an athlete. Now, obviously, I wasn't born to be Wayne Gretzky. I wasn't born to be on the PGA Tour. I'm not trying to suggest that I'm, you know, but the litmus test of what you're born to do is flow.
Yeah. And just if I may interject, so you prior to that,
mm-hmm.
you think that you didn't, you that part of you suspected you weren't an athlete or that you weren't good enough?
I would think that because of my, between you and I and anybody who listens, because of my family background, I would come out as a, I developed a core belief as a kid that I wasn't quite worthy, that I wasn't quite good enough. And I've had to do some things in my personal life, my business life, to overcome that. And so I decided to apply that to golf. And so I would start with that.
So some I am statements.
Some I am statements. And then I would write down for me what represented for me the golf of my dreams, which is being able to be in a senior tournament and being able to let golf be golf,
mm-hmm.
and shoot par or under par in a tournament round. And you were there for Oshawa, but you were also there at on the final day of the Club Link shootout.
Oh yeah. Well, so, just for the record, we had the Oshawa, which was you know, as low as it got for us competitively this summer, but we also had a 2-day tournament that we won together. Both of us playing on the second day, probably as good as either. It's the best both of us have played at the same time. I've talked about it on the show. I think between you and I, we made 9 birdies that day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was pretty cool to be part of it. I mean, both because usually, you know, they talk about guys in these tournaments ham and egging it.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't really doing that. We were kind of both playing very, very good concurrently. In fact, that's why, you know, we would have been even further. I think we were 5 under or 6 under.
Something like that.
As a team.
Yeah.
It might have even been 6 under. Well, whatever it was, it was pretty fun. Good. It was fun to be part of.
And I don't think that I don't think that would have been possible for me. I mean, I was, there was a couple other things this summer that happened that I don't think would have been possible for. And we're talking a subtle difference.
Yeah.
And the big difference for me was being able to come off of those rounds and look in the mirror and say, you know what? I let golf be golf today. I was in the moment. I enjoyed it. It was what it was. I didn't get in my own way. And for me, that's major.
Do you find it harder or easier to do that in a tournament round or in a non-tournament round?
For me, in a tournament round, for sure.
I'm not even sure I asked the question correctly.
Yeah.
In terms of like getting into a flow state, for me, I find there's a real distinction in my acuity when it comes to non-tournament rounds and tournament
mm-hmm.
rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't love playing golf for fun. You know, when you and I played a couple of weeks ago at Glen Abbey, we had a great time.
Yeah.
You know, enjoyed the day, but I just know I bring a different focus.
Yeah.
What about you?
I would say that's absolutely true. I would say that one of the challenges for me is when I play casual golf, especially casual golf at my club, I can get into a trance where I'm just, okay, I'm on number two. It's a par three. Oh, I'm on this tee box. It's a 7-iron. I'm not thinking about the target. I'm not thinking about it. I just get up, peg it, grab the club out of the bag, bash it. And when I'm in a tournament, it's then I don't want to function that way. And it's sometimes harder if you're into that mode, casual mode, mostly. That's why a lot of the guys that we play against that do consistently really well, A, they're, you know, they're likely better players, but than me anyway, but B, they play a lot of tournament golf. That's what they do. And so they don't have to, you know, switch this modality of thought. So for me anyway, that's
I think part of it is, you know, playing a lot more tournaments, which, again, I played 25-ish events this year. It's a lot of tournaments. Yeah. And you were probably similar.
Yeah.
I just find that I can get into that. That's a great way of describing it, where you go to a hole, it's a par three. You don't even really laser it because, you know, with that pin, it's like you're 7-iron and that pin's an 8-iron.
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's the best practice for playing tournament golf.
No.
But I also don't think grinding every round is productive. I think there's got to be some time. I would say the last tournament I played was October 7th, the last time I was in tournament guy mode. And the last month of playing golf, I've been in kind of like a pleasant, dopey trance, you know, where I've had some decent rounds. I've hit the ball okay, but I haven't really paid the same mental attention, nor do I bring the same acuity to it.
Yeah. So for me, what I've decided just the other day was for next year, what I want to do is decide before I tee it up how I'm going to approach the round. Am I here for a few laughs, totally, or am I here for a few laughs? And I'm trying to use this as a tournament prep.
I had my coach for a long time used to say this to me when I'd be on my way to men's night. He'd say, "Are you going to play today or are you going to practice?" And I used to say to him, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, are you going to use this as a round to practice some of the stuff you're working on, or are you going to play? Because you got to make a decision."
Yeah.
Because if you're going to play, you can't spend the day trying to fuck around with your golf swing. You've got to play golf.
Yeah, brilliant. That's, yeah.
What about the average player, as we wrap up this exclusive one-on-one with At Scratch Attitude on X, Twitter? And so the book was originally called Play Like Ray.
Yeah.
And now it's Scratch Attitude. And you're also working on another book that...
Yeah, I am. Two of them, to be honest, at the same time.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying to find... maybe you'd call it an authentic voice or whatever, but I want to, I don't want to just put something out there that's a regurgitation of what you can get wherever. So if I don't have something different to say, why do it? But to me, I've got, there's two, I like to share notes to myself, my golf self, and my tournament golf self. And there's a distinction there. So that's what I'm working on. And it's fun. We'll see if we'll see if I can actually finish it.
Well, we talked a lot about your book. We did a road trip together last April. And was thinking the book would come out this year. But you know what? Hey, Rome wasn't built in a day.
No.
You know, there's no hurry.
I've already got one lease seller out there who, you know, I don't want to rush to get my second one.
So as we wrap up our one-on-one exclusive with Ken Osborne, there's lots of good stuff that we talked about. I mean, the emotional quadrant of the cornerstones of your philosophy. I think the emotional one is something that doesn't get discussed enough. There's a pop psychology term. It's your EQ, your emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
What about the average player and their journey? Maybe they don't want to be like us. They don't want to play tournaments. Uh-huh. But they know deep in their heart that they're not having the kind of fun that you described when we began, the kind of fun that you were having playing beer league softball and giving out a artificial leg as a prize at the end of the each game, like that's a completely different kind of vibe than most golfers go around in.
Yeah.
There's a, you know, Tim talks a lot about the this sort of shroud of shame and and self-hatred, my words, that that follow a lot of golfers.
Yep.
So what do you think to the average player, as we say? What would you say to them?
Okay. I would say, frankly, you'd get some value out of reading my book. But I would say this, the one thing that you've got to do, you absolutely have to do, is you have to stop shitting on what I call shooting on yourself.
Yeah.
You have to stop it. You have to stop saying things like you fucking idiot, and and you know, how did I miss out? I hit it fat, I hit it thin, I did. You got to stop that, because when you put words to an emotion, we all get them. You know, if you and I hit a bad shot, there's going to be a little subtle wave of disappointment or frustration. I mean, that's normal. But when you speak to that, when you put words to that, you anchor that in your subconscious.
Yeah,
so what you're doing is you're anchoring a vibe, and then you're going to try to read a book to or whatever to get you out of that vibe. Meanwhile, you go back to the golf course again, you anchor it again. So you got to stop that. And that includes all complaining. The course, the pins, the slow play, the blah, blah, blah. That includes all explaining. Oh, you know, if I had done this, if I had to move this way, I had to move. Well, I don't know how that put moved left. I was standing over the ball. Am I this? And the other thing that you have to stop doing, in my opinion, happened to me yesterday. I was playing with a guy, and I said, "Oh man, great putt." He goes, "Yeah, you know, every now and then a blind squirrel."
Yeah.
Can you fucking imagine?
I know.
Muhammad Ali standing over George Foreman and going, "Yeah, you know what? Every now and again, a blind boxer lands a lucky punch."
I love that. The complaining and explaining subtly and overtly is what it's destroying. The golfer's confidence in little tiny bits at a time.
Yeah, and it's keeping you in that. See,
absolutely.
If you think about it from a emotional or spiritual point of view, it keeps you in that vibe.
Yeah, it locks you into negative vibes.
And there's a part of you or part of our brains that just wants to keep things habitual.
Yep.
Doesn't care what the habit is. They just so if you're doing that, You're making it harder and harder and harder to ever enjoy your golf. So that's the one thing I would say.
Well,
you gotta stop.
I love all of that. I mean, one of the things that I've quoted you many, many times on the show and in talking to other people is that, and again, it's a practice, it's habit building, it's learning to react to golf shots in only one of a couple ways, either neutral or positive.
Boom.
I mean, it's so simple, but it takes practice.
Yeah.
You know, when I hit a bad shot, which I do on every round of golf, I'm not explaining what happened, the wind. I mean, unless something completely out of the ordinary, or the way I look at it, I had a shot yesterday, hit the ball. As soon as it left my club, I thought it was great. And it, like, for the sake of half a yard in the air, it hits this bunker and buries under. I mean, all I could do is hit it, and it stayed in the bunker. But what my reaction was, my first reaction was, "Wow, I really hit that really well." And then when I got up to the green, I'm like, "Well, all I said was a little bit of bad luck. That's a shame."
Yeah,
and I gave it about that much emotion. But I know there was a time, and a lot of golfers listening can relate to it, where you. First of all, you get pissed off when you see what's happened to you. But also now you're complaining and explaining that for minutes after.
Yeah.
Whereas I got into the bunker and I went, okay, I know I can't get... It was in a situation where I knew I couldn't get it out, but I still had a third shot to hit from that bunker. And I made myself aware that, okay, now I need to hit this shot.
Yeah.
That's a drag. I acknowledged it, but it was a very neutral reaction as opposed to the preponderance of aggravation most of us give those shots.
That's big time. And you know, I was going to say, if you're a member in Oshawa, you got no reaction from me. And the fact that I ran over that squirrel on the way out, it was a complete accident.
Yeah. The fact that we, you know what we should tell everyone about the 290 yard par four that in a better ball tournament, better ball meaning one of us could have a lower score.
Yeah.
Both of us double bogeyed. A 290 yard par four.
Yeah, that swing thought of, you can hit it over that tree, Kent.
And, you know, the other thing, too, that I think I've taken from you, and I use it all the time, is the, so there's either a neutral reaction or a positive reaction. What's the third one?
Well, neutral, positive, or negative.
Yeah, so right.
And so, what guys tend to do, typically, what guys tend to do is they overreact
to the negative, right.
Yeah.
So they anchor, and then I know that's not completely yours, but I've talked about this a lot for a while on the show, that the more men in particular, Tim and I have talked about this, where we're very comfortable getting very angry. Mm. We're okay showing that emotion. Mm. We're not as okay showing a positive emotion. My point is, when you and I play, or when I'm playing with somebody, if I make a putt, you know, I don't always say boomala, but I fist pump. And yesterday, a hole after I'd hit this and buried it in the lip of a bunker, I made my first birdie of the day yesterday, and my only one. But the putt went in, and I was like, yeah. And it shocked the guys I was playing with. And they kind of mocked me a little bit, like, oh, I didn't realize this was a big event. I go, hey, that might be the, and it was true, that might be the only birdie I make today.
Yeah.
Why is
and
it
that's,
that?
That's why you're paying to be there.
Exactly. Why is it, why do you think men especially are more comfortable and almost embarrassed if they get too excited over a good shot, but they're fine if it's a bad shot and they complain and whine about it?
Yeah. I don't know, Howard. I mean, what comes to mind for me is that, you know, we're conditioned by watching the PGA Tour. I mean, the only time those guys ever express any emotion, typically, unless they're pissed off about a shot, is if they win a tournament.
Right.
Or they do something in the Ryder Cup. But normally they'll make these shots that you and I would die to hit one of them ever, and it's like oh hum.
But Tiger was different.
Tiger would do the whole yes.
Yeah.
Tiger also went. Tiger's dad, yeah. and you know this, but from the time Tiger was about 12 to 14, he visited an army psychotherapist on a regular basis and was hypnotized, and so. There's a book, Think Like Tiger.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no doubt in my mind that Tiger was able to anchor those moments into his subconscious.
Your journaling of the I am prompts and that kind of thing, it occurred to me when you were saying it that that's a form of self-hypnosis.
You create belief in one or two ways. You have an incident that's highly emotionalized, or repetition. And so, you know, if you can repeat the same messaging, if that messaging has some kind of connection to reality, then in time you'll believe it. I mean, a simple example of that is, you know, a parent telling a kid, you'll never be good enough, and another parent telling a kid that, you know what, keep at this, you can make it. Somebody's going to make it to the PGA Tour someday. Why not you?
Mm-hmm.
And you get that for 10, 15, either one of those for 10 or 15 years, that's going to absolutely shape who you are. So what I was doing with this exercise on a daily basis was repeating to my mind, yeah, you know, like, I do want this, I can do this, I am this.
And that's different than ego, isn't it? It's different than just thinking.
Well, that's where it has to be anchored into reality. When I'm writing down, you know, this is the golf of my dreams,
right.
And on the other side, I'm writing my convincers, I'm able to write moments where I can say, yeah.
What are things that, what, give me an example of a convincer.
Convincer for me would have been one of the things I write down is making the now I write down our last day at Greystone in the 2-day tournament.
Right.
five birdies.
Yeah.
And you made, I think, six.
No, we made, you made five, I made four.
Yeah.
The problem is we birdied, I think, a couple of the same holes, which was weird.
So I'll write that down.
As one of your convincing. So I get it. So, yeah, I am this. I want to be that. But here's something that gives me evidence. And why I brought up ego is that what you're talking about is different than ego, just thinking you can because your ego says, well, you're great with no real evidence, no real convincing.
Yeah.
So it's and belief. I love that word that you use. It seems to me that belief is different than ego.
Yeah, I think belief is tethered. To me, it's tethered to some kind of reality-based.
Right.
Because the subconscious loves that. The subconscious wants to see evidence as opposed to, you know, I woke up this morning and decided that I'm going to be an opera singer. I mean, I'm a terrible singer. So, you know, my subconscious is going to reject that as silly.
Well, Mr. Osborne, I knew this would be a good time to put this on tape, or do we even some digital record of the kind of conversations that we have from time to time, and I hope everyone will enjoy it. Kent's book is called Scratch Attitude, and his new books are called whatever the hell he wants to call them.
I think it's the first one's going to be Notes to My Golf Self.
I like it. Well, hopefully this will be a window or an opening or a doorway or some kind of vessel to help you, if you're listening, to start to rethink how you, especially if you're not enjoying this. You know, one of the things that you say about, you know, being a pay-to-play, being a pay-to-play player. Yeah, I mean, there's no tournament. All those tournaments we talk about, I mean, we paid to get into them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah, we did. I think both of us did pretty well in the Club Link cash, mm-hmm. but it certainly didn't pay for all the golf we played.
God no.
And as you've said, and we've said here on the show, like if you're not enjoying this, mm-hmm. then what are you doing it for?
Yeah, and if I just to finish, it's not about enjoying being with your buddies and enjoying being outdoors. It's about enjoying yourself where it really matters, which is when it's your turn to play. That's the key to the whole thing. And a lot of guys don't make that, or they separate that. Well, you know, I love being outdoors. I love hanging with my pals. So of course I love golf. Mm. But do you actually love your game?
Yeah.
That's what it's all about from my point of view.
I think it's brilliant. And I think a lot of, I say men, because I think women have a different, not all women, but I think a lot, for a large portion of women, they have found a way to separate self from, you know, their mastery of this silly game. Mm. Raymond Pryor talks about that, you know, separating self from this, your ability. And I think men don't. I think men are miserable when they play. A lot of men are miserable playing golf.
Okay.
All right.
Hopefully not us, buddy.
Well, other than that one day.
Yeah. Like I said, that running over that squirrel was a complete accident.
Fucking Oshawa. That's all. That's just so all y'all know. Every time Ken and I talk, somehow Oshawa comes up. And it's like the way I've, remember me telling you, like, the way we say Oshawa now is like when Seinfeld said Newman.
Yeah.
Oshawa. Thank you, Ken.
Okay. Thanks, Howard.